Welcome to Entrepreneurs the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer, and we are in alignment with the divine direction today with an incredible founder and CEO at Charity Water, Scott Harrison. Welcome to the Playbook.
Hey, it's so great to be here. I'm a big fan.
I'm a big fan as well. And, you know, time flies, and we were talking about having kids, and nothing makes time more relative than seeing your kids grow up. But I also believe that to be true with a business. And we've grown up together, my business and your business, as you're having your 20th anniversary. For you, an entrepreneur, when we look in front of us, time takes so long. But when we look back 20 years, it sure seems to have been a lot easier and a lot faster than it probably really was. So for you, what's some of the takeaways now looking back on the journey of how far you've taken this organization, especially considering the impact and the global water crisis that we have? Looking back, what are some of the takeaways that you have?
Well, it's funny. My wife is planning a 20th anniversary celebration in 2 weeks. And she's decided that the theme is going to be big on screen, in quotes, "We had no idea what we were doing."
Yes.
And I think, you know, if you go back to that founding moment, like so many of us, full of optimism, I was, you know, 30 years old, had just spent 2 years in Africa as a photojournalist. And, you know, I remember saying, I am going to start the charity that is going to be, you know, the charity above all charities. We're going to do everything different. We're going to solve every problem that people have with charities. And we're going to start with water. But that's only going to take a couple years to give 1 billion people water. Then we're going to move on to education. Then we're going to move on to health, right? I was going to be the Richard Branson of charity.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would just knock all these things off, you know, and take prisoners. And then I think, you know, very quickly reality sets in that building any business, building any movement, building any nonprofit is extraordinarily difficult. Requires, you know, 80, 90 hour weeks, 3 a.m. at the office, back at 7, a lot of sacrifice. And you're, you know, in those early moments, you're existentially always going bankrupt. I mean, you're about to just not become a going concern at any of those moments. But the dream is so big. The ambition is so big. The sense of possibility is so big. And I think, you know, like many of us, you just kind of keep working and grinding, and you put one foot after the other, and you get 9 no's and 1 yes. And then you go out and do 10 asks again, and you get 2 yeses and 8 no's. And you try to feed yourself on the yeses and the positivity and learn from the no's. And, you know, the next thing you know, you know, you're maybe not worried about being a going concern to the same degree. But I think you're still, so I'll kind of end that, you know, that train of thought that no idea what we were doing, really, really hard in the beginning. And, you know, now we've raised over $1 billion and we've helped 22 million people get water, and we've worked in 29 countries. And there's, you know, there's all these kind of statistics of what looks like success to others. And like you, I get to travel and speak and, you know,
so good.
Many times people say, did you ever think you'd be so successful? The flip side of that coin is, this is a fraction of what I've imagined. Right?
So good.
$1 billion is nothing. It's 1/100th of what we should have done, of what is possible. And then I think 20 years in, there's this idea that we are in the top of the second inning, if it's a baseball game. And I really hope the best is yet to come. I really hope, you know, we're 9 or 10 outs in a very long game where we can hopefully put a whole lot more runs on the scoreboard.
And I'm sure you will. You know, so interesting coming from the worlds that were similar and synergistic that we came from over 20 years ago, where you were a promoter of a nightclub and living in an outcome-based world where a lot of people are attached to, I'll be happy when, and
yeah,
these material types of things. And my life and your life shifted to a more for the sake of what. You know, I remember when I first, as I'm blessed to be part of, you know, chairman of Unstoppable, chief chancellor of Junior Achievement, and now recently chairman of Napoleon Hill Institute, I remind myself that my purpose has to be greater than the pain. And whether you're a promoter
or a the sports things, agent,
right?
Because there's a lot of people listening, David, that are still chasing the things.
Yeah.
And we've all seen people get the cars and say, that's not it. And then get the house, that's not it. Get the plane, that's not it. Get the girl, get the boy, right? And I think that's a really big, you know, we're both fortunate. I chased those things for 10 years.
Yeah.
And would get enough of them to say, wow, man, something's missing. Like, you know, it's like, we're not born for this world. This this idea that the possessions and the, you know, the things, the trinkets that we collect will bring that satisfaction. And it's really found in purpose and service to others.
It's like having a God-sized hole, and we fill it with everything but God. And whatever your belief of that is fine with me. Your God, not mine. But that really helped me. And another thing that came into my life in this 20-year span as well is, you know, I re-engineered and shifted my paradigm of being of service and of value and stopping the things that I was doing to interfere with my potential was humility. My mom's favorite quote, which is now behind me, my favorite quote is, you're either humble or you're about to be. And just thinking what your messaging is for your 20th anniversary party, it just seeps of humility. And as humble as you are, and I'm sure you try to be, we still experience the need to be right or control, prevent, defend. We all have egos. And for you, when you talked about being in the second inning, what inning are you in when it comes to what you believe your potential of truly living a humble life?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I'm like close to seventh inning stretch.
Nice.
20 years, good. David, will humble you a lot. Being married, having four kids. being married to someone who
question.
Worked along.
You have four kids. What do people do with bad kids? Because good kids are hard. They're really hard. I don't know what people do with bad kids.
Well, and I was that bad kid. I was an only child and I went prodigal. So I feel such a deep sense of sadness and empathy for my parents, you know, right. What I put them through. Like, you know, I was an only child that wanted to be a doctor when I grew up so I can cure my sick mother. Oh. And I announced at 18 that I'm going to go to New York City, run 40 nightclubs, do coke, chase girls, go to strip clubs and, you know, smoke 40 to 60 cigarettes a day. So my parents are like, what happened? Right. You know, we only had one shot at this. Like, what did this guy do? So thankfully, they waited long enough and it came back around and I was able to use some of the things I learned selfishly pursuing those goals and channel them. But I actually value humility a lot. And I think so much of it is, well, I'm a person of faith. So I think that helps me. You know, I do believe in a higher power. I call it God. And I think that I have a part to play in repairing the world. I think that, you know, I was put on this world. I was given many gifts. I was born in a middle-class family in Philadelphia. And yeah, my mom was sick growing up, but my dad had a job and there was food on the table and I never had to drink dirty water my whole life. I got to go to college and, you know, I kind of feel like I am responsible to use those gifts, my time and my talent and my money, to end needless suffering in the world, while also showing up for my family and being a great husband and being a great father and being a great friend, and then showing up at work and having high integrity and, you know, trying to lead an organization, you know, to also end suffering. But, you know, I think it's just a positioning maybe a little bit towards service rather than accumulation, which is what I did. I spent 10 years with 100% accumulation and 0% service. And it felt terrible.
Yeah.
Like it really felt terrible. You know, when you're left alone with your thoughts, you know, I remember having this moment, dude. I was in Punta del Este, Uruguay, and I was dating a supermodel and I drove a BMW and I had a Rolex and I'm renting a house, you know, on the beach with a yacht attached to it. And we spent $1,000 on fireworks and people are following us, picking up our towels behind us and folding them. And just thinking, you know, if I had a heart attack here, like the only thing you would write on my tombstone is here lives a selfish man who got 1 million people drunk in 40 clubs. Like, yeah. That's the only, I literally left like a negative legacy on the world. And, you know, I was very fortunate to kind of have that come to Jesus moment at 28 and say, I don't want my tombstone to read that. What does the opposite of that kind of life look like? And then that just led me on a pursuit of trying a little service and trying a little more service, trying a little giving, trying a little more giving. And, you know, I believe that the more you give, the more you give. You know, the same way people can get addicted to consumption and accumulation, you can get addicted to service and giving, to which there is no end. There is no finish line.
I love that.
Now, Rockefeller was asked in, I think it was 1909, how much money is enough? And he famously said just a little bit more. And I think, you know, if you ask the question of someone who is in service, how much service is enough? It's actually the same answer, just a little more. There's a little more to do. There's a little more to give. There's a little more help required.
My neck's getting sore from shaking my head. Yes, because I could not be more in agreement with the sentiments and philosophies that you have and the experience that I've had in the same divine direction. One of the more recent things that I've been studying, both of us living of service and of value and shifting from the strip clubs and the abuse of alcohol and drugs and the things that we're surrounded in the circles and spheres of influence that we were part of, is I've really looked at receiving as much as giving. And let me share why. As I got involved with the Unstoppable Foundation, which was founded the same way you founded a big birthday party with the transformational Jack Canfield and Bob Proctor and all these guys, gave Cynthia Kersey all this money to start building villages in Africa. She told me that I was given this opportunity to give people an opportunity to give, and that was greater. And I thought it was philanthropic bullshit, you know, to get people to give is a greater thing. And then through my study of receiving, I realized why people love to give and why it is addictive is when we're able and capable of helping other people, we're at our higher self, we're closest to God. And when we are like my mom, who raised 6 kids on her own, and my uncles who had money would be like, hey, can we buy the boys a car? Can we do this for you? And oh, no, we don't need that. Oh, no. She was actually cheating them of their higher self. And when you really understand the infinite circle of giving, where you give more to be given more, you're given more to receive more, you're now able to ask for more than more so you can give more than more, be given more than more, receive more than more, and ask for more than more than more. This to me is the definition of more than enough. And
I have a story I'd love to share.
Please.
That resonates so deeply with me. So I have had a hard time with this. I've had a hard time with receiving. You kind of go into giving mode and like, I'm going to outgive everybody, right? And I was with a pastor once in California. Northern California. And this pastor loved wine. He was a very successful author. I think the church probably paid him zero and he'd written a lot of books. And he learned that I like wine. And he takes me into his garage and he has this, you know, big wine fridge. And he gives me a $500 bottle of wine and a $400 bottle of wine. Now, I spend $25 on a bottle of wine, right? I'm happy to drink it if somebody else opens it, but he gives this to me, and I remember I was headed to San Francisco, and the next day I was meeting Johnny Ive from Apple. Johnny Ive, who designed, you know, the iPhone and the iPad, and he wanted me to have this. I felt kind of unworthy as the nonprofit guy of having a $400 bottle and a $500 bottle. So I turn up at Johnny's office, and I give him the $500 bottle of wine. Johnny Ive drinks $5,000 bottles of champagne. Okay, he has unlimited resources. And instead of taking the thing that my friend wanted me to enjoy, a bottle of wine that was 20 times more than I would ever spend on it, I'm like, well, I got to give it to somebody really rich and famous.
Yeah.
And then I listened to a message about the difference between, it was kind of a biblical parable idea of like the difference of being given bread and seed and knowing what you're given and what to do with each. So the pastor in this message was saying, you know, my son is a guitarist and he's really into a bunch of guitars. So for his 40th birthday, the dad goes out and he asks all of his son's friends, what guitar would he like? And he spends a whole lot of money on this unbelievable guitar and he gifts it to his son for his 40th. And then over the next like month, he doesn't see this guitar show up in any of the gigs, in any of the arsenals. And the dad is like, finally asks his son, like, what did you do with your 40th birthday present guitar? And his son said, oh, I gave it away. And the dad said, that was for you, son. That was not, right? And it's kind of like if you are given bread, you're supposed to eat it. And if you're given seed, you're supposed to sow it and plant it so that it can grow into something else. And I've really, that's helped me. Like, what is something I need to just receive and say, I am worthy. Someone's trying to be unbelievably generous. This is like bread to be. Because if you bury bread, you know what happens? Nothing.
Ruined. Nothing.
But if you eat seed,
you start.
Right? You're eating the future. Yeah. You're literally eating the thing that could grow and was meant for others. So that was really helpful to me. And I don't think Johnny I've ever get like that bottle of wine probably didn't even make his
right.
It didn't make his cellar. You know, it's like table wine.
Exactly. Oh my goodness. All right. Last question. 20 years of growth. I believe in exponentiality, right? It takes 90% of the time to get to 25% of the year. Then it takes, you know, just 5% to double in five. And pretty soon we keep go from 100 to 200% to 400 to 800. As you see the exponentiality of behavior, of goodwill, of goodness, of godliness, what do you see that is next? I know you have all the different categories, but there's still billions of people that you and I want to empower. What is next left to do?
I mean, my mission has been very simple for 20 years. Try to bring clean water to every single person on earth. So the simple belief that if you're alive as a human on our planet, you should be drinking good water. Okay. So we are 700 million people away from achieving that goal. Today, 90% of us drink clean water. Most of us take it for granted because we were born into that world of clean water. 10% of people are poisoning themselves. Many of the women are walking 7 hours a day at risk of rape or attack. Children are dying under five of diarrhea. You know, unthinkable for us in a world of Pedialyte and Walgreens, right? So the mission is very simple. I will know I am done that piece when 700 million people have water. When the most basic need for human life, for human health, for human flourishing is provided to all. So that's pretty simple. So I've only helped 21 million people. You put that into 700 million, it's 1/35th, right? So it's about 3%. So it's just kind of math. And I also believe in the inevitable math of networks. Should we get enough people who decide we want to solve this problem, we can. We've solved a lot of really hard problems before. You know, about 5% of SpaceX's market cap on day one could have given the whole world clean water. Right? We've now spent $12 billion looking for water on Mars over many expeditions, while 700 million people drink dirty water on Earth. So it's kind of a problem of will. It's a problem of movement. It's a problem of people saying, not on my watch. I don't want to live in a world anymore. And you know who gets this the most is kids. Mm. You know, kids are some of the best fundraisers. 6 years old, 9 years old, they'll go on charitywater.org. They'll look at a video and they're like, Mom, Dad, like, why are people drinking dirty water? You know, what? Like, can I do a lemonade stand? Can I donate my birthday gifts? Can I give my allowance? And I think, you know, we often can get so jaded and it's so easy to embrace apathy with any paralyzing global issue, especially ones that don't affect us, right? It's easy to get excited about ALS research or Parkinson's research or pancreatic cancer, because we all know someone who, you know, is close to us who has been affected by that. Dirty water? People are like, what? You know, people don't have water? It's so far. So I think I'm still filled with possibility. And I've experienced moments of radical generosity where I ask somebody for something and they say, what if I did an order of magnitude more? Or why did you ask for so little when so much more is available? And, you know, I was at dinner, maybe I'll end with this story. I was at dinner with a very wealthy man in Pennsylvania, and he offered enough money to build about 100 water projects for 100 communities. It was a big amount of money. And I just kind of said in that moment, I said, well, what if instead of that, that's amazing, thank you, what if you helped 1 million people? That number was 50 times more.
Mm.
And he thought about it. And a couple of days later, he said, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do 50 times more than the very, very generous thing I said I would do. So I think that inspires me that, you know, there's kind of like a well underneath us of generosity, of radical generosity that is tapped into every once in a while. And the distraction and the consumption and our Instagram feeds and the news, the bad news all around the world has almost like hardened that layer of rock. But every once in a while, you tap into it and you see a geyser of explosive generosity, and it fuels you and it keeps you going.
And it fuels me and it fuels our community. And can't but forget a line that Bob Proctor had told me years ago, just planting seeds under trees that I may never sit under. And if you want to build a future of what we can become, water is the number one. We're 80% water or so, and you can put your intentions in water as you drink it, but if it's dirty, it will not help anyone. And I am asking on behalf of our friend Scott Harrison for everyone to reach out at Charity Water, to be abundantly generous, to be that geyser that can change the world. If we just took a fraction of what we spend on defense, if every leader in the world would take a fraction of what they spend on defense and put it towards water, this problem, as you said, would be solved. What we pay attention to and what we give intention to equals the coincidences, the coinciding of our universe. And it takes great leaders, philanthropic leaders, heart-centered leaders like Scott Harrison to take 20 years of his life to change the world. Scott Harrison, I honor you. I appreciate you. Just make me one promise. You'll please come back.
I'd love to. And let's not wait 10 years.
That's for sure. God bless you, my friend. Keep doing the great work. We also will be making a donation in the name of our show.
Awesome,
for having you on. We are very involved in the water business in Kenya right now, but there's always more that we can do. So yeah. I appreciate you, Scott. Thanks. And
thanks,
happy anniversary.
Work.
Awesome. This is Dave Meltzer, another amazing edition of Entrepreneurs, the Playbook.